have scheduled today a public hearing on three rules petitions and then an open rules petition conference. We have a public hearing on 1307, which relates to amending SCR 1004 and 1005 relating to offices in the Board of Governors. And in conjunction with that, we have Rule Petition 1313, which was filed by Attorney Steve Levine and other active members of the Bar to review changes in the state bylaws, state Bar bylaws, which are related to Rule Petition 1307. So what we shall do is we're going to treat 1307 and 1313 together in our presentation, since they are intimately related. And our presenters are going to be Patrick Fiedler, President of the State Bar, and then Stephen Levine, counsel who filed 1313. And I have other appearances of Roberta Howell, counsel to the State Bar, Raymond Alusto, who's a governor, that is on the Board of Governors of the State Bar, George Brown, who's executive director of the State Bar, and Douglas Kammer, attorney from Portage, former president of the State Bar. And then we'll give rebuttal time to Mr. Levine and the State Bar, whoever is selected. Does anyone else want to appear? If so, please give your name to the marshal. And if you feel the urge to appear hereafter, you can, at the appropriate time, rise and make an appearance. So we'll start with Mr. Fiedler.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. We appreciate the opportunity to appear here today to express the State Bar's overwhelming support to Petition 1307. The Bar is required to promote the public interest by maintaining high standards of conduct. Our organization, consisting of over 24,000 lawyers, must demand the highest level of conduct from its members. In turn, members, as well as officers and governors, should expect that the State Bar will do everything in its power to protect its members and the entire legal profession by creating and sustaining a healthy organizational environment, one that promotes diversity, good governance, and sensible policies. Petition 1307 would authorize the State Bar Board of Governors to establish a line of succession, define a board vacancy, and add a much-needed removal provision. As to the removal provision, I would note the following. First, the State Bar Board of Governors Governance Committee has been discussing the removal provision for some time. Second, the board ultimately decided that the threshold for removal of a governor or an officer was to be set at 75% of the total membership of the board, including the governor or officer subject to removal. Third, the goal is to provide a mechanism for the circumstance where a governor's or officer's conduct is so detrimental to the board and to the legal profession that it warrants this type of action. Fourth, examples might include embezzlement of funds, conviction of sexual assault or other crimes, inappropriate use of powers, or other serious misconduct. Five, while the State Bar is very fortunate not to have experienced a governor or an officer acting in such a manner in its 135-year history, the Board of Governors felt that it is necessary to have such a policy in place for our organization. And six, the proposed provision in no way is intended to have a chilling effect on debate or participation at board proceedings.
Well, as President of the State Bar, put in Mr. Levine's proposal that it doesn't restrict First Amendment rights.
That is correct. And Mr. Levine, at the board meeting at which this was approved, it was approved 38-2, brought a motion with some specific language contained in his brief. That was defeated 3-37, I believe.
Why, when you're not trying to stifle free speech,
I think
in?
It becomes a matter of degree, and the safeguards in place here include the 75% requirement. That is of the entire membership of the board, which is 52 members, so you would need 39 votes for removal. This is the type of thing that I would envision would come up by way of motion from somebody who is a member of the board, would require a second. The person whose removal is sought would have the opportunity to answer to those charges.
Is it reviewable by this court if you dump somebody from the Board of Governors or an officer?
I don't believe there's any language in that regard. I would certainly think that potentially it could be the subject of some type of legal action.
Why?
As it relates to, I'm thinking something analogous to some type of written certiorari type review. As it relates to whether or not the board acted appropriately?
Mm-hmm. Mr. President, I think there's some concern in the judiciary about judicial recall, and that goes to other branches of government as well, because there doesn't seem to be any necessary cause for recall. Is there a cause for removal? Must be established?
It has to be something that is not in the best interest of the State Bar.
But now that's not in 1307. 1307 says that you can remove on the basis of the bylaws. And the bylaws are the ones that say what the cause is. And if we adopted 1307 as drafted, then you could change the bylaws anytime you want without court approval. The only thing the court can do is disapprove by a petition of, 25 or more members, which is what happened here. So in response to Justice Prosser, 1307 has no cause. You have to look to the bylaws that are brought here by Mr. Levine for the cause. And it's, misconduct is contrary to the best interest of the bar. Right?
Correct.
I mean, and that's probably the cause that's being debated here as being too vague.
Correct.
Would it be in the best interests of the bar to have, for example, a president who was in favor of a voluntary bar?
I don't think that that would violate the standard. I mean, one of the things that the bar is always going to have, since it's comprised of lawyers, is a lot of differing opinions in that regard. And this is not – the intent behind this is not to stifle anyone who would come forward and indicate that we should have a voluntary as opposed to a mandatory bar.
The intent sounds fine. What you're saying here sounds fine. It's the unintended consequences that could happen sometime down the road that we're – I think, trying to think about, anticipate, and sift through here. So I think that's part of where the questions might be coming from.
Well, and I can understand the concern in that regard. Subject to oversight by the Supreme Court, we are a self-legislating body. And one of the things that we had noted, because this has been the subject of study for several years, is that certain organizations, other bar organizations, do have this, certain ones do not. Our concerns were as follows. We gave you examples in Ms. Howell's brief about a situation where an officer of a bar in another state had sexually assaulted a 15-year-old, and there was not a removal provision. I realize here there's a removal provision if you get convicted of a crime, potentially. But what was talked about would be a situation where, because of someone's acts or words, potentially they would not be able to effectively serve in the position they hold, be it an officer or a governor. And I realize that somebody can hold one of those positions and espouse viewpoints that are not popular with the majority of the other members of the Board of Governors. That's not the intent. I understand the question you're asking beyond that. What about future actions, et cetera? one of the things that was debated was, should we have a specific list as it relates to misconduct that would be deemed to be not in the best interest of the bar? And the debate kept coming back to, if we do that, inevitably we're going to miss a situation that subsequently arises that was not foreseen, but that the vast majority, would see as something that should be subject to removal. So would this, in effect, leave it up to the current Board of Governors, which changes every year as it relates to what their view of best interest of the bar is? I suppose that could be seen, but like any other legal standard, oftentimes that's in the eye of the beholder.
One of the areas that you covered in defining public interest was an area that gave a litany of what sounded to me like felonies. You know? And that leads me to the question of, must an attorney be a member of the bar in good standing in order to serve on the Board of Governors?
I know it's an excellent question. I know you have to be an active member and in good standing.
Let me back up just to give a little context of where I'm coming from, and that is we have, and of course, our lawyer discipline rules, temporary suspension for criminal conduct that is shown or proven. Now, there's an example here of the state bar president from Minnesota getting in a little trouble, I think, with the sexual assault of a child. But if that were a situation where someone had pled guilty, very likely there would be an acknowledgement of the crime, even if it had not yet come to fruition in a judicial sense. There very likely would be a request from OLR for a temporary suspension. And that's what leads me to my question. When you gave the laundry list of these felonies, they sounded to me like, if proven or acknowledged, that they would be the subject of a petition from OLR. I mean, they are egregious. They're pretty black and white. You know, what's in the public interest seems to me there's going to be a lot of gray in there. But so you have to be in good standing. I return to my question then after providing that context.
If you are suspended, you're still an active member, so you could remain in office.
Okay.
So maybe the test is whether you're suspended, that you should be removed if a lawyer, he or she, is suspended. Now, we have temporary suspension not only for, not all felonies, only felonies that reflect trustworthiness, honesty, and lawyer ability. That's not quite the language, but it's close. What if your president was charged with homicide by drunk driving?
Well, in that type of situation, if a motion is brought, then there could be debate on that and the potential for removal, assuming the person did not resign. That's obviously going to be taken up on a case-by-case basis. One of the things that I'm assuming that the board members would consider is, with this pending charge, which is a very serious one and typically is going to be taking up a lot of this individual's time, potentially there's a lot of publicity, some of which may be adverse to the bar, is this person effectively able to serve in a leadership role?
There isn't a conviction or charge which is open in public, but the OLR is investigating the president of the bar or any officer or member of the Board of Governors for a violation. And it looks as if it might be serious. Now, that's going to take a lot of the officers or governor's time, but it's still all very hush-hush, so nobody knows about it except OLR and the individual involved. What about that?
That sounds to me like the type of situation where the board itself would not be aware of that pending investigation.
Well, but if you're worried about time, and if you're worried about the person not being able to do the job because he or she is going to be busy, they're going to be busy if there's an investigation. And we've got a petition pending that says if it's really very serious investigation, we ought to, court ought to reveal it. And my assumption is the bar is going to not want that.
I'm not so naive. The bar is not going to want it to be revealed.
That's right.
That is correct. That would be consistent with the policies we passed in the past.
Right. So as long as it's all secret and hush-hush and the president is totally overwhelmed by all of this, you're not going to remove him. But as long as it becomes public, then, or at least one member of the board knows about it and is in a position to talk, you will remove them under the bylaws.
Again, this seems to, I want to emphasize.
Subject to removal by
subject to removal.
75% vote.
75% of the total membership, not dependent upon if they're all there.
You know, we used to have a rule, maybe we still do. It was a rule sort of governed after the military rule of acting like an officer and a gentleman. And I think that used to be the rule discipline, that you should be subject to discipline if you, as an attorney, didn't act like an officer and a gentleman. I don't know if we still have that. We'll have to look that up. I'm sure we de-sexed it or degendered it, but we'll see. Because that's what, contrary to the best interests of the bar, reminds me of, is general vague.
I was looking at the rule. Is best interests of the bar defined anywhere? Because maybe that would be helpful.
No, it is not. And that was one of the things that the committee, which looked at this over the course of a couple of years, considered and determined that this is the language that is the most appropriate as it relates to giving the board the opportunity to weigh in on certain types of misconduct without specifically delineating them and then inadvertently omitting to list one.
You know, go ahead.
I was just going to say there might be general concepts that everyone would agree upon that would fit that definition that would create, you know, a level of security to people who think that their First Amendment rights or other rights or unintended consequences might flow from this. Maybe there's a way to think about that, to define best interest of the bar in a matter that would be satisfactory. I don't know if there is or isn't, but certainly there are things the bar shouldn't do if it's a mandatory bar, and there are things the bar should do if it's a mandatory bar, and maybe in promoting diversity of thought would be, you know, something that you're saying here today wouldn't be excluded. You know, if, for example, someone thinks the bar shouldn't be a mandatory bar, some people, to me, that seems like that would fit within the definition of something that's adverse to the best interest of the bar. But maybe you're really not saying that. I don't really know what is and isn't in the best interest of the bar. I guess that's certainly a sexual assault. That's an easy example to me, but there may be other ways that a person wouldn't be able to qualify, you know, like the chief mentioned, if you had something like they had to be a member of, because I don't know the answer to it. That's the tough part.
All right. If I could, Justice Ziegler, I'd like to have Mr. DeLasto address that. He was on the committee, was very active in writing the bylaw language.
Okay, now just hold 1 second. If we could just, Mr. DeLasto is listed on our list, so.
Okay.
Let's just, if we can.
All right.
We can hold a question, mark it down, if this is okay with Justice Ziegler.
I'm just thinking out loud, you know, trying to figure out how safeguard your.
And obviously, it is easy to distinguish sexual assault as opposed to the debate over should this be a mandatory or a voluntary bar. But as to the latter type of question.
Mandatory or voluntary bar?
I'm sorry?
You mean You don't mean mandatory or voluntary bar.
He does.
Do you think he does?
The example that was raised by Justice Zeger.
Do you know that Nebraska decertified, deunified its bar?
Yes, they did it. And I don't have the case citation in front of me, but that related to a situation, I've been told that related to a situation that did not exist in Wisconsin. We do a Keller review every year.
All right. I'm just pointing it out to you since it came up. Sorry, it's an aside. Go ahead.
I'm done.
All right.
Just
to briefly follow up on one of the points you raised, I think in the former situations of sexual assault, everyone would agree that that would be cause for removal. As it relates to the latter situation, I don't have the statistics, but I can simply tell you anecdotally from the number of members I've talked to that there are still a great number of members who feel that the bar should be voluntary. They may be supportive of the bar, but they don't like the fact that they are mandated to be a member of it. And
well, they keep electing presidents who aren't in support of mandatory, you excluded, but, you know.
Well, actually, when I was running 2 years ago, one of my planks was that I was I was tired of the issue. I mean, I can recall this going back to, 1987, et cetera, and then they had a decision eventually that came out of the Seventh Circuit. To me, I would just as soon move on to other things. But I respect the rights of those who continue to want to raise that issue.
I missed that last part, Judge Fiedler. What did you say?
I said I, as it relates to the debate over should it be a mandatory or voluntary bar, I've got issue fatigue on that.
You have issues with what?
Issue fatigue on it, Justice Fiedler. It's been something that I've been hearing about since approximately 1987. And that's just not something that I think – it's not something I'm devoting any time to.
The one of the parts of this proposal that catches my eye is – and it's recited several times – that the remedy that the state bar would offer basically an accused under the circumstance would be, well, a challenge should be brought as an as-applied challenge. And the state bar asserts that even if this court has concerns that the state bar may wield its removal authority, these should be addressed only in the context of a specific circumstance where the affected individuals and organizations' respective interests can be appropriately balanced. So, in other words, try it out on a case-by-case basis. That's what it seems to be.
And that potentially would be the effect here as it relates to getting back to the concern raised about the best interest.
And so a practical question that arises in my mind, I assume if litigation ensues that the state bar's position would be represented by attorneys who are paid for by the state bar, in other words, by the attorneys of this state through their application of their dues. Yes?
Yes, which is no different from the situation we've had where there have been past challenges brought by individuals as to the mandatory voluntary question.
Well, of course. You're going to be able to hire lawyers to represent the state bar's best interests, however those are defined. And I wonder about the accused. Is there any... This individual who is accused of crossing the line of something that we're not setting forth with any detail or specificity, but gets to be the test case, they pay for their own lawyer, I assume, under this scheme.
Well, obviously they would be a lawyer. They'd either represent themselves or pay for their own lawyer. Somebody would undoubtedly represent them.
And we're both aware of the old adage about the lawyer who represents him or herself. Fool for a client. Typically, in your experience, well, in my observations, attorneys tend to hire attorneys to represent them when their interests are at stake. And obviously, we both know, everyone in this room knows, that legal bills can get awfully high. The stress and length of litigation is also something that is quite burdensome. And I wonder how these facts, and they are facts, if you wish to dispute them, good luck. But how has that entered into your thought process in proposing this?
Well, as it relates to that, I was not on any of the committees that debated this. What I have heard has been the informational presentations that have been given at the various board meetings, and then which culminated in the vote last June by the Board of Governors.
So you take no position on that part of it, but you are here advocating.
You know, Justice Gableman, if you're any type of litigation or dispute you're talking about that involves going to court or some type of thing analogous to a court situation, it's the norm that people go with a lawyer and typically pay for that lawyer.
Mr. Fiedler, the state bar is set up by the court. We mandate that people join it. And on the other hand, the court does not micromanage it, but can't amend the bylaws, for example, doesn't set the bar dues, et cetera. But I think that the bar is I don't know what kind of animal it is when you ask, is it state action for purposes of the First Amendment? Looks like formed by us as mandated by us to practice law. We govern, we regulate the bar. And so this First Amendment issue troubles me because it's state action. And if it is, or it looks that way, then you're held to First Amendment criteria for state action. And I just am surprised why you didn't put that in. I don't know that it would cure the problem, but at least makes an attempt to narrow what you mean by best interest of the bar.
Well, I appreciate that. And again, this was the subject of a lot of discussion among the committee members and as well as on the floor when it was presented to the Board of Governors.
Okay.
Mr. Fiedler.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Justice Prosser.
You used the phrase in your opening remarks that this has been under consideration for some time. Could you define that?
Yeah, I believe it's in Ms. Howell's brief, and my understanding is that there would have been what are called, it would have been presented as an informational item, and I believe that it was at four separate board meetings, but if I'm incorrect, it's correctly stated in Ms. Howell's brief. And we had the vote on it last June, so the informational sessions would have occurred in April of 2013, January 2013, and the other two are escaping me. And I don't know if that all took place within one bar fiscal year or if there was some overlap. Going back before that, it was also something that was looked at, I believe, as early as 2004. So the impression I have is that this is something that has been under consideration for some time. So, say, going back to 2004.
The brief says, establishing a removal procedure has been considered the bay for years, dating back to at least 2003, as part of a package of comprehensive changes to the bylaw, and that's in the minutes. And that doesn't seem to have gone anywhere between 2003, and then it was again considered, I'm reading from page 5, creating a provision on removal beginning in 2010 by when Jim Ball was president. So my assumption, which may not be correct, and maybe Ms. Howell can further define it, is that it may have started in early 2000, but that it took on significant discussion in 2010 and then continued through 2013. I mean, that's what I drew from this, but I don't know that my inferences are correct.
I think it's a fair inference.
Counsel, as I read the new bylaws, removal of a board of governor is now kind of in three categories. Number one, I will say, if they are not in good standing. By that I mean that they are, according to the bylaws, revoked or suspended. That's what I mean by not in good standing. So number one, you're removed if you're not in good standing. Number two has a combination, unwilling or unable to serve. And three is that the conduct is contrary to the best interests of the state bar. Now, I personally have no problem with the first one. That is, if they're not in good standing with the bar, seems to me that's reasonable. The second one, unable or unwilling to perform. Give me an example of unwilling to perform.
Well, for instance, what comes to my mind is, what if they don't show up for any meetings? I mean, they're, you know, if they're a governor, then they're elected by their particular district, et cetera, or they have status as it relates to a member of one of the four divisions or one of the appointments by this court. What if they simply don't attend any meeting and there's no excused absences? It's all unexcused absences.
And unable to perform?
Well, what comes to my mind in that regard is some type of medical or mental incapacity.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, by and large, those seem pretty reasonable. So the real catch is, for me personally, is the conduct which is contrary to the best interest, because it's so vague. Can you respond to my concern on that third, the vagueness, a rather amorphous term used?
Well, in that regard, again, Justice Spradley, what I would come back to is one of the safeguards relates to the supermajority that is required in order to effectuate a removal. The person has to, a right of confrontation from the standpoint of they have to be presented with the grounds for the removal, that type of thing, so that there is notice, have the opportunity to respond. When it does go forward for a vote, if it does go forward for a vote, they have not relinquished at that point in time their right to vote on it. Again, there's 52 governors presently, and what that would require is, in order for removal, 39 people would have to vote in favor of it, regardless of how many people show up for that particular board meeting. Obviously, there would have to be a quorum for the board to go ahead. And the trade-off that was debated as it relates to that, the conflict between best interest of the bar, again, goes back to the very difficult, if not impossible, task of putting together a laundry list as relates to specific types of conduct that would constitute grounds for removal, and then having a situation come up where somebody does something that clearly should be the basis for some type of removal proceeding, but there's nothing in the bylaws that would cover that. And so I guess after the fact, we would then have to look at whether or not it would be possible to amend the bylaws for something that's already occurred that probably could not apply back to that past conduct because at that time it was not prohibited.
That's why I started out the questioning making reference, my earlier question, to the OLR and the temporary suspension, because I think that a lot of the examples you gave could fit under that avenue. Would they all? I don't know. But a lot of them could fit under the avenue of a request for temporary suspension because of this kind of criminal conduct. So I'm looking for examples other than the sexual assault, the misconduct in office, and those kinds of things that wouldn't fit under that first category that would likely bring an attorney to a situation of revocation or suspension.
All right, well, my understanding as it relates to, for instance, the person who holds the position of president, they may have a disagreement, and all of our policies obviously are passed by vote, and depending upon the type of thing we're voting on, it may require a majority or supermajority or what have you. But let's assume that the Board of Governors passes a policy, it doesn't matter what it is, related to some aspect of the law in the state of Wisconsin. We use one right now that's being considered in both the Assembly and the Senate, which relates to what's called the Second Chance Bill, taking nonviolent 17-year-olds who've never been in juvenile or adult court before and having them start off in juvenile court as opposed to adult court. So that would be a change of the law that became effective in 1996. The State Bar, and I believe it was in 2007, as the Board of Governors came out in support of this. So that's one of the policy positions that we have. All right, so currently it is making some headway in the legislature. Let's assume that because this happens to be my year, I decide that personally I am against that legislation. And then I go out and become very public as it relates to why I think this is a bad idea. As it relates to, you know, if I don't hold the position, no problem with that. As it relates to the fact that I do hold that position, I'm actively working against something that's already been passed as a policy. I think potentially that would be contrary to the best interests of the state bar. But again, that would be something that somebody would have to bring a motion, get a second. I'd have to be confronted with the specific charge against me, have the opportunity to respond, and it would still require a supermajority.
It would be easier if the bar passed a rule that no officer shall publicly oppose the position set forth by the board in lobbying. I mean, is that really what you want, if that's so?
Well, that was just the one example I gave, but that would have been something that not necessarily would have been on this specific list. That would have been one of the options here.
Well, that may really be a First Amendment issue.
I have no problem with my right as an individual to take that position publicly. The distinction I draw is if I hold this position, then I think I'm acting in the contrary to the best interest of the bar by actively campaigning against something that they have signed off on.
Counsel, a good example that comes to mind is the Board of Governors, in many instances, has taken the position of an integrated bar. Then you get some bar presidents who are advancing that it shouldn't be integrated. How does that fit into your example of best interest of the
organization? I think that's a very good question, particularly in response to the example I've given. I think that debate, despite my personal issue fatigue, is going to be around forever, certainly longer than I am.
But it's a clear example of an officer, indeed a president,
right,
advocating directly against a policy of the state bar that has been affirmed and reaffirmed by the state bar. So,
and in addition to that, was elected president on the platform that they're going to disintegrate the bar.
So maybe that's not the example they want. We'll just pull that example back for the moment, and maybe it is, but I'm just saying it's a little...
You know, I think that the fact that you require a supermajority is a potential protection, but not a very good one, frankly. I'm sure we can all think of examples in small groups and in large groups, in legislative groups, in court groups, where in the heat of the moment you can get 95%. Or 100% agreeing with a particular item. And when things cool down, they don't agree with it. So 75% doesn't do very much good in this situation where officers and board of governors have short terms. The officer has a one-year term, right?
Right.
Some of them. So by the time you can cool down, that's gone. And isn't the best thing if the officer is contrary to the interests of the bar is to don't, or the governor, you don't vote for him the next time, or her. You run people against them, and you don't vote against them.
I don't find it out of the ordinary that we as a, I guess, legislative body, when we're talking about the board work, would be seeking provisions for removal, and there are certainly examples in the U.S. Congress as well as the state legislature.
Do they use against the best interest of the legislature?
That I would not be able to answer as it relates to any specific body as far as what their particular standard is.
They have impeachment. They have rules of their own for governing themselves, and maybe you should look at them and see it. And there are rules for what a judge can do, but, you know, you want to give people notice. And what maybe you think in the best interest of, against the best interest of the bar, I might think is really in the interest of the bar to put something public and discuss it. So, anyway. All right, any other? Justice Brasso.
If you would read the newspapers about this court, you might get the impression that every vote on this court is 4-3. You have lots of close votes in the Board of Governors. You got 52 members. How many 27 to 25 votes are there?
The most recent one I can remember would be last June when we were seeking passage of what is now this year's budget. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but that was a very close one. That may have been decided by one vote.
Is that typical?
I wouldn't say that that close a vote is typical, and I'm just going on my experience for the last year and a half. So that would be, I guess, 7 board meetings.
How often are there, say, at least 39 votes for something?
Well, I don't mean to be flippant, but I believe there was on this petition.
Yes, but I mean, frankly,
you know, Justice Prosser, it just depends upon what it is, people draw their own conclusions based upon the debate, et cetera. They are given the information ahead of time. Typically, we have at least one informational session ahead of time, and then the paperwork is made available to them, et cetera. They may discuss it among some of their other members, but as it relates to something being decided by one vote, the only example that comes to my mind in the last, 20 months would be the budget bill that passed last June.
You know, you need a supermajority for lobbying.
60%.
So maybe you can tell Justice Prosser how many votes were defeated because they couldn't get 60%.
How many votes would defeat?
How many
issues that are lobbying couldn't get the 60% vote?
You mean as it relates to specific issues?
You have a 60. Look, you have a supermajority in other instances, but go ahead.
Let me ask a little different question. I think, a false impression about how this court votes, I might have a very false impression, and that is that the Board of Governors would not ever be confused with the greatest deliberative body in the world. In other words, that very often the votes are extremely lopsided. There's the prevailing view, and people rally around, you know, magnetic figures like Pat Fiedler, president, who honor the president. I don't get a sense that there's all kinds of dissension in the Board of Governors.
There is dissension, but, you know, I think what the example you're giving would relate to your impression that on most of these votes that we're taking, if there are some minority votes, there's not a great number of them. And without looking at past Board of Governors meeting minutes, I wouldn't be able to answer that with any specificity. But, you know, do certain things pass unanimously? I suppose it happens, just nothing is coming to mind.
Well, maybe Mr. Brown can tell us about divisions at the board and whether a supermajority of 60 is readily reached or not, and at what percent of times.
But let me ask one other question. As a member of the legislature, almost always in the minority, there were a couple of times where I thought the majority was acting very much out of line and was about to do something without really demonstrating any due process. Some criticism of a member for something. I don't quite understand what the process is here to protect the interests of an office holder before a removal. You have the grounds, but how quickly can those grounds be stated and then a vote taken? What are the protections for the person who's the subject of potential removal?
Right. Well,
it's in effect an impeachment vote. What are the protections for the removal?
The protections would relate to that they would have to be advised of the specific grounds for removal. They'd have the opportunity to address those. There would be debate in that regard, and then there would be a vote.
And how much time passes?
Conceivably, that could happen within the same meeting.
The bylaws do not state how much time, how notice is given, how much time, what are the opportunities to you can appear, apparently, but doesn't say you can have a lawyer, it doesn't say you can bring witnesses. None of that is in the bylaws. Right?
Right.
Okay. That seemed fair.
Well, again, it gets back to if the supermajority feels that the conduct is not in the best interest, then I am not arguing that this is perfect any more than any accusatorial system is. But another thing that it has to be balanced with is this person is acting against the best interest of the bar. How long are they going to be allowed to remain in that position and continue that type of activity?
Are there any other comments? Okay. Mr. Fiedler, you will have time for rebuttal, or you may designate someone else.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Levine. You have a microphone? No, the way we've set it up, as I understand it, Julie, and the agreement of the parties was to do 1307 and 1313 together, that we would have Mr. Fiedler, President Fiedler first, Steve Levine second, and then other appearances, and then rebuttal Steve Levine and State Bar. Now,
unless, Chief, the only question I have is, part of the things that we were asking Judge Fiedler, he deferred to Ray DeLasto on, and I just wondered if Mr. Levine wanted to hear what his answers were instead of just being stuck with rebuttal after he hears that.
Mr. Levine has time in rebuttal, too, for that reason. I'm sorry. First of all, you have a microphone, right? You know, it's easier if you all would reach an agreement, which you did, advise me, which you did, set it up this way, which I told you, rather than change it. But I'm flexible.
I'm also flexible. If the court would like me to go next, that's fine, too. If Mr. DeLasto, it'll be more convenient for the bar to have his comments right after President Fiedler's. If the court would like it that way, that's fine with me, too.
I'd prefer if we stayed with these two and then move into the comments, okay? Are you prepared to proceed, Ms. Levine? All right. I mean, I'm assuming that this was done for a reason and that we should stay with that rationale. Mr. Levine, you're here as opposing to petition 1313, the bylaw change. And it is the bylaw that determines cause for removal, right? And 1307, which is a change to 1004 and 1005, says removal as set forth in the bylaw. Right?
Yes, it's basically giving the state bar carte blanche to allow whatever bylaw, to adopt whatever bylaws it wants.
All right. And you oppose the bylaw petition and therefore oppose 1307 adopting the bylaws in the rules.
Yes.
Okay. Your turn.
Thank you. Your Honors, my name is Steve Levine. I'm an attorney from Madison. I'm here today to speak in opposition to 1313, the bylaws that were adopted at the State Bar meeting of June 12th, and also in opposition to giving the State Bar the authority that it requests in 1307 to adopt bylaws to remove members of the Board of Governors, as the bylaw says, if 75% of the membership of the Board of Governors finds that person has acted contrary to the best interest of the bar. I have to say, in introduction, last night I was staying up late and I had the news on. And there was a news program in which former Secretary of Defense Gates was being interviewed. Some of you may have seen, he's just written a new book about his years as Secretary of Defense. And he quoted from the book, he said, "The most important principle that I've learned being Secretary of Defense, but in all the years that I've been in various positions of government, was this, quote, never pass up an opportune moment to keep quiet." I'm sorely tempted to follow his advice, sitting here listening to all the court's questions this morning, because basically I think you've made better arguments against these bylaws and against giving the bar this authority than I could make. But I'll try to be as brief as I possibly can. I won't go into the history of the adoption of the bylaws that are at issue in 1313 unless you have any specific questions, except to mention this. At that meeting on June 12th, when these bylaws were adopted, I did propose an amendment to protect the First Amendment rights of governors and officers from not being included as a basis for removal under those bylaws. The vote against that amendment was 34-3. That's 92%. You asked earlier, Justice Prosser, about how often and how lopsided votes on the Board of Governors can be. In my experience, this is not atypical. Most votes are overwhelming like that. But if I had written a novel, and I put in that novel that 92% of the Board of Governors had voted not to extend protection for First Amendment conduct to their own members, nobody would believe it. You know, my question is, the bar says, trust us because these bylaws require a 75% vote. And yet, it was so easy for the Board of Governors, by a 92% vote, to reject First Amendment protection for their own members. First, with respect to the bylaws adopted in Docket 1313, I think the court should reject those bylaws without even looking at the merits of the bylaws, simply on procedural grounds, and I just want to make three quick points. The major point is that at that meeting on June 12th, and even on this very morning today, the bar had no authority to adopt the bylaws, and as of now, it has no authority to adopt those bylaws. And there are three points. First, the bylaws specifically are inconsistent with current Supreme Court rules. Under Chapter 10 of the Supreme Court rules, the State Bar is given the authority to adopt bylaws that are not inconsistent with the Supreme Court rules of Chapter 10. These bylaws are. Supreme Court rule.
They are inconsistent. Why? Because the bar rules provide a fixed term, 1 year, 2 years, whatever.
Exactly. The Supreme Court rules say governors are elected for two-year terms, and they also specify the length of terms for officers. And there are no exceptions there. The language doesn't say 2 years unless removed earlier by the Board of Governors, or 2 years unless extended by the Board of Governors, or not more than 2 years. They're specific terms. There's no explicit language anywhere in Chapter 10 of the Supreme Court rules that gives the bar the authority to shorten those two-year terms. The State Bar cites as examples of organizations that can remove their own members, the United States Congress, and the state legislature. But the only reason that those organizations and others cited by the State Bar have the authority to do so is that they're given explicit authority, in the case of Congress and the state legislature, in their constitutions. If that language were not in those constitutions, if the other organizations cited by the bar did not have that specific language, they wouldn't have the authority. So there's no authority anywhere explicitly in Chapter 10 of Supreme Court rules that gives the bar the authority to remove members. And the final point as to why the bar doesn't have the authority to adopt bylaws to remove members is that the bar itself says it doesn't have the authority to adopt bylaws to remove members. In its memo, in Docket 1307, in which it states the reasons why it's asking the court to amend its own rules to give it the authority, it says, should a member of the board be guilty of misconduct or have his or her license suspended, quote, the bar has no recourse to act in the best interest of the organization should removal become necessary, unquote. So the bar itself says in its memo to the court, we have no recourse, we have no authority to adopt bylaws, so please give us this authority. So basically what happened is that at this meeting of June 12th, the Board of Governors decided to adopt bylaws that it knew it did not have the authority under Supreme Court rules to adopt, and then to come to the court later and file the petition in 1307 to give it that authority to adopt the bylaws that it already adopted. The State Bar is the organization that every May 1st on Law Day tells the public, respect the rule of law, obey the rule of law. The rule of law is what separates civilization from chaos. And yet here we have a situation where knowingly the bar adopts bylaws without the authority to do so and then comes to the court in 1307 and says, give us the authority to do what we've already done. I hope the court doesn't sanction this kind of conduct.
Mr. Levine, I understand that point. One of the things that bothered me was, as I read the bylaws, which were in Exhibit C, 7A, that you don't seem to be objecting to in the bylaws, says, if an officer license to practice law is revoked or relinquished during his or her term, the officer shall immediately be removed from office without further notice. If the officer's license to practice law is suspended for a term less than the time remaining on the term, the position will be considered temporarily vacant. Do you object to that bylaw? Because I didn't see that in your petition.
No, there are two responses, Your Honor.
And there's a similar one in 10A relating to the Board of Governors. You know.
First of all, I just assumed that if the court voided any part of the bylaw under the court's policy, the entire thing would be...
Okay, so the whole thing is...
Right, the whole thing.
That issue, okay.
But the second, to answer your question more specifically, Supreme Court Rule 1005-3 and 1004-1 say that in order to be an officer, you have to be an active member of the state bar. If you're suspended or if you have your license revoked, you're not an active member anymore. So
Mr. Fiedler said that you are. He said that if you're still shown on the bar's list as an active member, even if you are suspended. Now, that doesn't seem right to me. And I think we had this discussion with the state bar where the court objected to that. And then this was taken care of, but I didn't go back to find my notes on that. So I would like we dealt with Mr. Brown on this topic, which related to how you show somebody who was suspended on the state bar's website. So I would like when Mr. Brown speaks, he addressed that. Okay. Sorry to have interrupted you, but a different response was given to that same question by the previous speaker.
Again, the main argument, as far as 1313 goes, is that the court doesn't even have to get into the merits of whether on policy it's a good idea or not a good idea. The court can say to the bar, you adopted these bylaws, you had no authority to adopt the bylaws, therefore they were void right from the beginning. And we don't even have to get into the policy. Now, in 1307, we can get into the policy. The bar is asking this court for the authority to adopt bylaws with any language that the Board of Governors approves to remove either officers or members of the Board of Governors. Why should the court not give the bar that authority? Again, there are three main points. As the State Bar said in its brief, and as President Fiedler just told you, in the entire history of the bar, I wasn't sure whether we could go back before the mandatory bar. In the entire history of the mandatory bar, 58 years. But this morning, President Fiedler said, even before that, when the bar was voluntary, there have been no instances whatsoever of governors or officers having their licenses suspended or revoked. The horrific examples that the State Bar listed in its brief of State Bar officials committing assaults, mishandling hundreds of thousands of dollars, whatever the example, none of it has ever happened in Wisconsin. So if any solution could ever be called a solution in search of a problem, this is it. The bar is coming to the court and saying, we need this authority. It's important to us to deal with this crucial and pressing problem. It hasn't happened in the last 150 years, but it's so important a problem that we need this authority. Point number two is, if this ever does become a problem, if in the next 58 years of the Bar Association, if a situation like this could come up, there's already in the State Bar, or in the Supreme Court rules, a mechanism to deal with it, as we were just discussing. In order to be a State Bar officer or member of the Board of Governors, Supreme Court rules currently provide that you must be an active attorney. If you are suspended or you have your license revoked, I agree with you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. You're no longer an active attorney. And automatically, you would not be able to serve on the Board of Governors. First of all, we're dealing with a situation where if a person were to be convicted of a serious crime or embezzle a great deal of money, that person is going to resign on their own, practically speaking. But if not, current rules, which require a person in order to be an officer or a governor, to be an active member of the State Bar would kick in, and that person would no longer be able to serve. Finally, in addition to the problem that there is no problem requiring this authority, granting the state bar unlimited authority, as it adopted in the bylaws in 1313, is a danger that's a much bigger problem than the non-existent problem cited by the state bar as a basis for acting for this authority. As I mentioned earlier, 92% of the Board of Governors voted in favor of rejecting an amendment that would have protected the First Amendment rights of officers and governors. In its brief filed on January 3rd, the State Bar said, "We want that authority. There could be instances in which it would be appropriate to eject a person from the Board of Governors on the basis of conduct protected by the First Amendment." The very idea that the Board of Governors would disrespect the First Amendment enough to say this would be an appropriate basis for removing somebody from the board, I think, presents a much greater danger than the non-existent problems the State Bar cites in the whole history of the bar in Wisconsin as requiring this authority. So again, there is no problem. There hasn't been a problem since the beginning of the bar in Wisconsin. None of the evils that the State Bar cites as requiring removal have ever happened in Wisconsin. And if they do happen, the automatic provisions in Supreme Court rules requiring that bar members or that members of the Board of Governors be active members of the State Bar would kick in and solve the problem. Giving the State Bar this carte blanche authority to remove a member of the board for any reason, including exercise of First Amendment rights, is one of the most dangerous things that I hope the court has ever heard the bar propose and that it rejects. All of this leaves the court with three alternatives. The first alternative would be just to say no, to reject the bar's petition and say, you don't need this authority because the problems that you cite for it have never, ever happened in the entire history of the state. So it's unnecessary. A second alternative would be to give the bar exactly what it petitioned for in Docket 1307. In its petition and in the memo in Docket 1307, it said that we're asking for this authority because if a member of the Board of Governors were to have his or her license suspended or revoked, we have no authority to act to remove that person. So if you want to give the bar some authority to remove members of the Board of Governors, limit it to exactly what the State Bar asked for. Situations where a member of the board has had his or her license revoked or suspended. And I proposed in my brief language that specifically says that. And I think that's a compromise that would serve the interest of the bar and members of the Board of Governors, because the bar asks specifically for authority to remove members that have their license suspended or revoked. And most of the instances cited in the bar's brief, these horrific things that have happened in other states, are going to end up with licenses being suspended or revoked anyway.
So the bylaw language I read to you about revoking and suspending licenses would be satisfactory if put into the FCRs.
Right, that's the language that the second alternative I suggested in my brief, with language specifically limited to letting the bar remove people only in the case of suspension or revocation. The good thing about that from the viewpoint of members of the Board of Governors is it would protect First Amendment rights and rights of dissent because it would limit what the bar could remove people for. The final alternative is to give the bar this wide scope of authority that it wants, but to specifically place language in your rules that I've also suggested in my brief, protecting the exercise of First Amendment rights by members of the Board of Governors. I read the language that I crafted over and over again. I don't like it. I'm scared of it, basically because I tried to make it as tight as I could, but no language is ever as tight as you want it to be. There are loopholes that the bar could exploit. The bar could even say, we're not subject to this. So I wouldn't even trust the own language that I suggested in that third alternative. I would say that if you want to adopt a compromise proposal that serves the interest of all parties, if you want to do something, the second alternative is the best way to go. Again, this authority is not necessary. No problems have happened in the entire history of the state bar. But if you want to give the bar some authority to deal with members who have had their licenses suspended or revoked, limited to that specific language in order to avoid the problems of abusing the authority by the board and removing people for exercise of First Amendment rights. Any questions, comments, reactions? I'd be glad to.
Were you part of the Keller amendment?
Was I part of what?
The Keller revision so that you, the bar had to state the amount that was on lobbying that was not protected.
I didn't have anything to do with that, I think.
But you should claim total credit for it in light of Nebraska. Mr. Frosted.
I think you make some very effective points. The one that strikes me as not particularly strong is the one that in effect requires suspension or revocation. It seems to me a governor can have charges filed against him or her and while they're in office, and it'll often take much more than a year to get those charges resolved. Now, there's I think sort of a presumption of innocence that goes with those charges. They have to be established, but there are some times when the bar conscientiously might think, this is pretty darn serious, and there's process that needs to be followed before there's discipline, but we can't be stupid about this either.
Actually, Your Honor, is one of the few points, I'm glad you set that forth, that I couldn't disagree with you on more. I would hope that a group of lawyers, the Board of Governors of the State Bar, would have enough respect for due process to say, let's let the process unwind. Just because charges are filed, whether it's criminal charges, whether it's charges of misconduct of an attorney for violating the rules, let the system unwind. What if you go through the whole system and this court were to say the charges are baseless or the charges don't merit suspension or revocation? I would think that if anything, a group of lawyers would want to celebrate not only the First Amendment that I was talking about before, but enough due process to say we aren't going to jump to conclusions.
There's some confusion here. I understood you to say that you would have an officer removed if the license is revoked or relinquished.
Yes.
Is revoked or relinquished. I heard Justice Prosser talk about removing an officer if there was a charge. Now, and you respond, no, if there's no charge, don't remove them because it might be dismissed. So what is your position? No,
what I'm saying is this. There are all kinds of ethical charges that can be filed. And frankly, the court does not always go along with those charges. But on the other hand, suppose there was a member of the Board of Governors who's basically accused of taking thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars out of a trust account. That would be incredibly embarrassing to the bar, and the money isn't there. But how do you react to that? Do you have to live with that?
My answer is a very strong yes. I mean, if due process doesn't mean anything to lawyers, who should it be important to? The whole idea of law is you wait until due process unfolds, and then you make a conclusion. What you're saying, Your Honor, is a charge is enough. What I'm saying is let due process unwind. If the person is found guilty after due process, then remove them. But removing somebody on the basis of a charge, rather, you know, that hasn't been substantiated, that the whole process hasn't found to be true, I think is entirely contrary to what we're taught as lawyers. I mean, due process is what law is all about.
Is there any kind of provision for presumption of innocence in this procedure?
As I see it, there isn't. All you need is 75% vote of the Board of Governors.
Right, and it could be wrapped up in a day.
Right.
It could be wrapped up in a day.
It could be wrapped up in an afternoon.
Are there any other questions or comments? Mr. Levine, you will have time in rebuttal, too. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments, and thank you for your briefs, and I will say the same thank yous to the bar. And now I have down Howell, Dalstone, Brown, and Camera. I don't care if you change the order, Mr. Dalstone.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice and Justices. I feel somewhat responsible for this, in that when I became a governor back in 2010, the then President Bowl set up three presidential committees, one on the bylaws, one on policies, and one on governance. And I got appointed to that. I wanted policy, but it ended up policy was to review all of our past policies for the bar, make sure they're still current, what's their status, and winnow out what is superfluous or no longer is relevant. That's an ongoing process. Bylaws looked at bylaw changes that had been proposed, needs that we had. There were bylaws, as was mentioned earlier, that had been out there since 2004 and 2006, which included some succession. In governance, where I was on, along with other governors, and these were just governors members on these committees, succession as well as was the main focus that we agreed upon after several meetings. And succession was, as has been discussed this morning, there is really no automatic succession if something happens. President or a governor is in a car crash and they're disabled for 2 months. What happens? Do you have to go through and have a vote? And does that take away the electoral ability of all the bar members by doing that? So we felt, and I, for good or bad, became the chair of this subcommittee to look at succession. What we first did is looked at other bar associations. We looked at the ABA. We looked at a county like Dane County. We looked at the previous bylaw proposals, Michigan, Minnesota, Illinois, and also I looked at the National Center for Nonprofit Boards, as well as corporate boards and what their proposals for succession and removal and officer vacancies would occur. I also looked at the a nonprofit that I used to be the legal director of, their affiliate in Wisconsin, the American Civil Liberties Union, which has a removal but not even for cause provision. And that was of some topic historically back in the early 50s when two board members were removed because of their political affiliations. But that was not the intent of the governance committee and the subcommittee I chaired. We wanted to put together a mechanism, and that's what's been presented to the court, and we ask that you approve it, which will have a temporary vacancy provision in Section 6. If an officer gets in the car crash or is unable, then they can be temporarily their office vacated, and then you have the line of succession automatically moving in. If there is a removal, and as has been the topic of discussion this morning with the Chief Justice and others, right now you're still on the bar's list of membership as active if you were suspended. We felt
How can that be? Can they
practice? It is. We asked.
Can they practice law?
No, they can't practice law, but they're still on the roll.
So are you suggesting that a member of that, a lawyer, who is suspended and can't practice law but is still on listed as active, can continue to be president? Is that your position?
We felt that the current laws or bylaws and rules as they are structured now is, yes, that is a possibility. And we felt that that would be not appropriate. And we felt that that should be dealt with because they weren't practicing. And so our focus of about four-fifths of the time of our meetings, and this stretched over probably five, six meetings over several years, was on succession, on temporary vacancy, on suspension versus revocation. We did bring up and talked about the possibility of criminal charges. My background, I largely do criminal defense. In fact, have a sentencing in federal court in Milwaukee this afternoon. So we'll be over there switching gears. It's still under fire, though. I also am active in representing lawyers and doctors in licensing and discipline matters, and I do civil rights work. So I was very cognizant of the concerns that past President Levine has mentioned, and these were brought up. Justice Bradley mentioned, well, why couldn't you have the litany of felonies or clause and whatever? And being of Catholic upbringing, the litany of the saints or litany of sins here was part of one of the suggestions that I pushed for. But my position was voted down. And you have to have in any organization that give and take.
Careful about what you say about your position because it may be contrary to the best interests of the bar.
Ultimately, Madam Chief Justice, instead of the litany or no cause or the words for cause, well, how do you define cause? The sense and votes of the governance committee was that rather than go to the old moral turpitude or call in the disrepute, which that language I think is fraught with too much case law and is too archaic, it was felt ultimately that best interests would of the bar would be the reasons for it. Would I have personally preferred a litany? Yeah, but then once you start on that road, well, then what about this or what about that that doesn't fit within that? But I clearly, I asked the court not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. A lot of work went into this. I think you have clarification now on who is going to be succeeding and how that automatically worked. It's going to talk about revocation or suspension of license or relinquishment of license. It also can talk about a situation we would hope if an officer was charged with, as one of the examples was, a homicide by intoxicated use, or an officer was charged with either criminal or an ethics or violation or a civil suit for taking money out of the trust account. And I've defended lawyers in both of those contexts. We would hope the lawyer would want to say, well, wait, I'm a member of the Board of Governors for a year. I volunteered and got elected for that. Maybe it's in my best defense interests or personal interests to take a temporary leave until the matter is done. And if I'm an officer, the same thing. And most reasonable people would. So the removal provision that has taken up about four-fifths of the discussion this morning, that for the best interests of the bar, that is part of this whole structure. That would be the last gasp if you had somebody who refused to go and had his or her name was in the papers every day. Yes, there is a presumption of innocence. And if I'm his lawyer representing him in the criminal case or the ethics case or the civil suit, I'll be out there defending him or her. But would this be inimical and not in the best interests of the bar and its operation? And we felt there should be some kind of means. It would be used, I think, if it's used in the next 58 or 158 years once, I think that would be a lot. But we wanted to have a provision as part of this structure just for good governance. When you look at the better bylaws books of the National Nonprofit Organization or standard bylaws, you should have removal. Should there be cause and should cause be specified? We felt that this plus the supermajority 60% for a lobbying position for the bar to take before it can be approved, that's 60% of those present at the meeting who vote. This is a super majority because it's 75% of all of the members of the Board of Governors, including the person who has a charge brought against them for removal. Justice Gableman asked about, well, could this all happen at one time? Conceivably it could, but with notice, I would think it would be the best sense of lawyers who are concerned with due process
right,
and the law and procedure.
And you should note, sir, that my question was based on the observation made by Mr. Feed.
That's correct. And I think it could happen, but I think it would be highly, highly unlikely.
How often does the board meet?
Every 2 months.
Okay, so if he gave notice in month one, then I assume nothing would happen at least until month three, right?
Correct. And we did discuss in committee, excuse me for interrupting, Madam Chief Justice, that the possibility of calling a special meeting, but it was felt it would be at the next Board of Governors meeting, at which everyone would have to be there.
Right, which you might not get. So it might be 4 months thereafter.
Correct.
And it may not be completed in one sitting.
Correct.
Maybe 6 months then thereafter.
Possibly, but...
And it's a one-year job.
That's right.
And it would have had to happen the first month that the person was president to do it 6 months. Now if it happened 4 months afterwards, the term is over.
Right, and we went through those scenarios in the committee. Well, what if it was the third week of the term back in July versus in April? The due process, while not directly called for, I mean, the inertia of the process and the timing is going to, I think, provide a person ample opportunity to present a defense, and I do not think a charge that would be based upon, in my experience, and knowing the members of the current board, as well as the past presidents and current President Fiedler, again, I think these are people of deliberation. These are people who would not go lightly if there would into trying to remove unless it was clearly in the best interest. And not to have a removal provision, at least according to the nonprofit organizations, as well as general corporate structures and bylaws.
Let me just ask you this. Sure. In a nonprofit, there's no condition of membership in the first instance. Here, you have to be a lawyer.
Yes.
So there are safeguards that I don't see this. To me, that's not the most persuasive point yet.
No, but it was one we felt for good governance, we should have that. And what I'm saying is, I think we put in, you have a succession ability, you have a temporary vacancy provisions here now, which I think are appropriate. And the removal for not in the interest of the best interest of the state bar shouldn't become the primary lightning rod for the destruction or the rejection of the total package here. And I would urge you, all of you.
But what if, instead of defining it as not in the best interest of the bar, you were to define what the bar's interests are?
We talked about that, and you probably have a book on it, what the interests would be. Is it interested in equal rights? Is it interested in property rights? Is it interest in due process? The problem is we're trying to write a bylaw and a rule which is succinct enough that it would cover all bases. We have removal if you're in the auto accident, removal if you're temporarily disabled, removal if your license is suspended.
Give me five examples of things that aren't in the bar's interest, things that the bar wouldn't ever promote or be interested in.
What if?
About same-sex marriage.
What if same-sex marriage, a bar president or a governor decided that they were going to be out there advocating strongly against what is constitutionally protected? Or what about, that would be one thing.
Having so ideological someone, activity.
Pardon?
Ideological activity.
Ideological could be one. If a bar president decided that he wanted to now announce that he was a closet member of the Ku Klux Klan or the Nazi Party, or on the other side, I don't know if they're still around, the Communist Party on the far left, but and then begin to push the bar to advocate this, causing a lot of public focus and press focus and making every meeting of the Board of Governors a shouting match, causing the board not to be able to do its work. That would be inimical to the best interests of the bar. Simply advocating for disintegration or going to mandatory, non-mandatory, in my view, would not be against the best interests of the bar, nor would it be cause. So
maybe you'd be better off defining ideological activity, and then that would be what's carved out. It's just a thought.
Sure. Because of my ACLU background, I didn't want to get into that First Amendment thin ice. Because then are we trying to limit speech?
Are you satisfied with the procedural protections of any potential subject for removal in your rule?
I am, sir. And I think that was the comment was made by one of you that this is akin to impeachment. Yes, it is. And you've got impeachment at a super majority with the board membership that would all have to be there. You could have counsel. There would not be, and this was talked about in our committee meetings, would not have to be any limitation on your right to call witnesses. In fact, I'm sure this would be the sole subject of that board meeting, and that might run all day if you had.
How could you call witnesses if you didn't get notice until the day of the vote?
On that end, it would be the officer shall, okay, let me just read the. And it was felt that notice would be given before any vote on the motion, notice of motion to remove and of the grounds alleged against the officer, and an opportunity to be heard by the board must be given to the officer. It was our sense that the one day run it right through that just scenario Justice Gableman postulated would not occur because we would not let it occur.
Once again, I have to correct you. It was the president of the state bar who postulated.
Okay, excuse me, sir. Could it be done? Possibly, yes. I think in reality, no, given the sense of lawyers and the sense of the members of the board and officers who do care about due process.
No, Mr. Kammer, in his filing, submitted minutes of the Board of Governors pointing, this is in the court's binder 8, I think it is, pointing out that when these bylaws or the subject of these bylaws came up in 2008 and again in 2009, that they were very much related to his and other persons advocating for a voluntary bar. And that was the ideology that caused this.
Well, I have an easy out on that, Madam Chief Justice. I wasn't on the board at the time.
All right.
However, I can say historically that the provisions for succession and removal, different ones had been in the bylaw drafts from the mid-2000s before President Kammer and President Levine were on. So this has been out there, but they've been for whatever reason, not moved forward. And that was President Bowles' position that we should, well, finally do it then. So it wasn't an ideological attack, more on the case-by-case. And, again, seeing that you have automatic succession for certain things, you have the temporary vacancies with the line of succession, and this third thing would be the last gasp or the last covering all provision, which just in case we had to use it. That was considered to be part of good governance. So, unless you had any more questions.
I would just like to make this comment so I set it up for the next speakers. Seems as if you all are advocating that an active member can be one who is suspended. Well, 10.03 sub 1 says membership in the bar includes all persons who become licensed to practice law in the state. All right? And then it says only active members may practice law. So you're saying only active members can practice law, but not all active members can practice law because suspended lawyers cannot practice law. Well, there's something missing then in the bar regulation because the penalty for non-payment of dues says the member may be suspended. And no person whose membership is so suspended for non-payment of dues may practice law during suspension. So we're all tied up that if you don't pay your dues to the bar, you're not an active member and can't practice. But if you're suspended for sexual assault or homicide or embezzlement, you are an active member. And suspended, you are an active member of the bar. At So if I went on the bar side looking for a lawyer, I could hire him. It would be in violation of the code, but I could hire him.
Yes, Madam Chief Justice.
We have to change the regulations.
Well, that's what we felt, too. The non-payment issue, you can have someone. I'm representing a lawyer now.
Hopefully we won't get here on that issue.
Counsel inactive just as a class of membership. Isn't that correct? And you have to be licensed. You become licensed to practice, and then you have to enroll. It's right after that.
That's right.
And then you are an active member, even if you're temporarily or if you're suspended or revoked, you still pay the your active member and you still pay the active member dues.
Correct.
Yeah.
So that anomaly we wanted to fix because it didn't quite seem consistent.
Well, I don't think
you haven't
fixed with this.
You haven't fixed it. Not in these provisions. Thank you. Ms. Howell?
I had an outline of a whole argument prepared, but given the comments and the questions that have occurred, I think I'm going to sort of skip right to the response to some of the things that we've heard rather than regale you with some of the things that you've already been discussing and asking questions about. First and foremost, let me start with the most important point, and that is...
Your name.
I'm sorry?
Your name.
I apologize.
I know your name, but you're representing
And I apologize. Yeah. Thank you.
That's the most important.
The most important point of all, Mr. Levine says, look, this is an issue that's never come up in 150 years, and so this is a problem looking for a solution or a solution looking for a problem, rather, and why are we even bothering with this? And this is a rule that the bar hopes it never, ever has to invoke. This is not something that the bar is putting out there because it has a list of people that it wants to go after. This is a rule that hopefully will never, ever be used. But you know what? The bars in Kentucky, the bars in Rhode Island, and the bars in Minnesota hoped they would never be in a position where they were going to have someone that they needed to come off of the board, and they were stuck. Rhode Island had a board member who was embezzling funds. Minnesota, you saw the newspaper articles and the materials that were submitted. Kentucky, there was a fee dispute. There was also a bar president who removed members of an ethics board and who were on a firm with which she was having a dispute. Those are all circumstances which may or may not rise, particularly in the Kentucky situation, may or may not rise to the level of criminal behavior where you've got presumptions of innocence and long procedures, et cetera. But they were not circumstances where that person should have been serving as a member and officer of the bar, but the bar had no mechanism by which to address that. Fortunately, in each of those cases, they were able to convince the person involved they should resign in the best interest of the organization, but there was nothing that required that person to do that. If you saw the materials from Minnesota, every single one of those newspaper articles, the first thing after that person's name is their firm affiliation and the fact that they were treasurer of the state bar and soon to be president. Those kinds of things brought serious disrepute to the bar in a situation where the bar should not have been in that position and would not have been in that position had it had a procedure like the one we're discussing here today. As to the active suspension, inactive, et cetera, the anomaly, Justice Abrahamson, arises in Rule 1003, sub 3, because the classes of membership there are defined and effective, essentially an active member is somebody who's not judicial, not active, and not emeritus. And that's where the anomaly comes in, where someone may not be, quote-unquote, in good standing because they've been suspended.
Well, you got another petition here in 1309, which we're going to hear, and you didn't fix that anomaly, did you?
I'm sorry. Okay. I'm not involved in that petition,
right.
So I don't
know
the answer to that question.
We'll check it out.
I also wanted to address this whole issue of somehow, because, you know, as you mentioned, in the heat of battle, you know, people, you get essentially mob rule, right? People get all excited, everybody gets convinced, and it shouldn't be that hard to come up with the majority that's involved here. And I think the answer to that is that's exactly wrong. And that it's no different than in a jury situation, right? We have a situation where there's process, the person involved gets to talk about and explain why they shouldn't be removed, if they in fact believe they shouldn't be removed, or why the charges that brought against them are wrong.
In a jury situation, the judge can issue a verdict not judgment notwithstanding the verdict, and you get one definite appeal and potentially two. And I don't see anything in this that allows for appeal.
That's correct. And that level of procedure is not here because we're not talking about depriving someone of their life or their liberty or a pile of money, even if we're talking about a civil suit where someone is charged. We are talking about removing someone from a volunteer position. Now, a
is
position,
it a position of prestige and honor?
And that is correct. That was going to be my next sentence.
And removal is therefore dishonorable.
Yes, but the removal itself is not what brings the dishonor. It is the behavior that leads to the removal that brings the dishonor. And there is procedure in place which allows the person to make their case, explain why that behavior should not lead to removal. But it is the behavior that leads to dishonor. And it's because that behavior brings dishonor, not just to the individual, but to the bar, that the removal procedure is set up the way that it is.
Counsel, were you present at that June 2013 meeting when this was passed specifically? I'm wondering if you can respond to Mr. Levine's assertion that 92% of the bar voted against the amendment that would have protected First Amendment rights. There must be more to that story. I don't mean to suggest you're leaving anything out, but it certainly takes me aback, so there must be maybe a little different view or something.
Well, I was not at that meeting, but Mr. Brown was and can speak to the specifics of that meeting, but there is a separate response to that, Your Honor, and that is the 92% was of those people that were present and voting. That is a very different thing than the 75% that's required for removal. 75% is of the total board membership, including the individual whose removal is at issue.
As I understood the comment, it was to be an illustration of sometimes people can be a bit cattywampus, you know. And 92%, again, without further explanation, takes me aback whether it's 92% of the people present who are voting or 92% of the larger group. So that's why.
What's a quorum at the board?
I believe a quorum is 24. So, and that feeds into the other point I wanted to make about the percentages, because those percentages can be misleading. For example, in the context of the 60% that's needed to approve or disapprove a lobbying position of the bar, because a quorum is only 24, it would only require 18 people to approve a lobbying position of the bar, even though that's 60%. Here we're talking about a very different and a much larger number, 75% of the entire board, whether or not they're there.
How many times do you ever get the entire board at one of these meetings?
I reviewed about 3 or 4 years of board minutes. I can't remember exactly how many, and I don't think I saw one where there was everybody at the meeting.
You may never be able to put this into effect.
Potentially. I think that's if the conduct is sufficiently serious, I think the likelihood that you end up with too few people to have that vote is probably pretty low, but yes, potentially that's an issue. That's a protection for the individual that's involved. And the bar, that's a stronger position and a stronger protection than in all of the examples you've seen and that members of Congress and members of the state legislature have.
Yeah, but, Counselor, you don't have to have everybody present to have 75% of the Board of Governors approve the recommendation. All you have to do is get those 75% there. Everybody else can stay home.
That's correct. But you would need to have you'd essentially need 100% vote of the people at that meeting for it to occur. Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
How many times then do you get 75% of the board present at the meeting?
That I don't know the answer to, Justice. Mr. Brown may be able to answer it. I don't know without actually reviewing the minutes. The second point I wanted to address was the idea that these bylaws are inconsistent with this court's rules already governing the bar. I think the answer, I understand Mr. Levine's argument. I think that the argument is not completely off the wall. I certainly would never say that. But I do think that the rules are consistent with this court's rules, not inconsistent. The rules say that the purpose of the bar is to uphold high standards of conduct In fact, I'll read it because the language of the rule is better than I can paraphrase. Purposes of the association are to aid the courts in carrying on and approving the administration of justice, to foster and maintain on the part of those engaged in the practice of law high ideals of integrity, learning, competence, and public service and high standards of conduct. This rule addresses that. The point of this rule is to protect that.
If you think you have authority to adopt these bylaws, why are you coming in here with an amendment to 1004, which says officers may be removed from office and vacancies filled in accordance with the bylaws, and 1005, which says governors can be filled in accordance? If you don't need it, why are you here?
And I think the answer is the very proceeding that we're in today. Reasonable people can disagree about that, and this removes any question about the bar's authority to adopt the bylaws.
I have another question, and that is Mr. Levine's 1313 objects to the two removal provisions. He didn't challenge other provisions in these bylaws.
That's correct.
So I said to Mr. Levine, are you challenging those? And his answer to me was that with this petition, he views the whole bylaw would drop, and that we wouldn't pick and choose. Is that your position?
I think that position is based on comments that have been made in this court in the past, that the court will either reject or adopt a bylaw proposal in its entirety. I think that there has been some tweaking, shall we say, around the edges when bylaws have been here before. For example, when we were here before on bylaw amendments concerning the arbitration proceedings and the Keller dues procedures. So I think I don't think there's a specific provision that says the court can or can't do one way or the other. I think in practice the court's rule has generally been to reject or adopt, but at times there has been some, they say, tweaking around the edges of that practice.
So you feel that if the court did want to reject part of the proposal relating to removal, it could reject all of it under the petition before us.
The court gets to do whatever, frankly, that it wants to do with respect to the bylaw.
So that doesn't surprise you or shock you?
It does not.
Okay. Just checking.
I also want to address the First Amendment issue because I think there's been not very focused discussion about that, because the First Amendment here, as you raised in earlier questions, Justice Abraham, it's not entirely clear whether the First Amendment applies in the context of the Board of Governors or not. For purposes of the argument, we have assumed that it did, and we responded to the arguments that were made. But there is no clear case law that answers that question one way or the other. So assuming that the First Amendment does apply, First Amendment rights are not absolute. As the cases that we cite in our brief explain, public employees whose livelihood is at issue, not a volunteer position and not even a volunteer position with prestige, but whose livelihoods are at issue, can be fired from their positions for exercising their First Amendment rights, but that is where the as-applied and facial challenge issue arises, where the rights of the entity and the rights of the individual have to be balanced based on what is the matter about which the First Amendment rights are being exercised, and what is the impact on the organization.
So you're saying that the officers and the members of the Board of Governors are public employees?
We are assuming for purposes of this argument that they would be. I don't think there's an answer to that question in terms of the case law, et cetera. The bar is a unique entity. I think in one of the constitutional cases that I was involved in many years ago when we were talking about the mandatory bar, the Latin phrase is, and I'm going to mispronounce it, sui generis or generis. It's a unique organization. It is a governmental entity, at least for some purposes, as we know from the Seventh Circuit's decision in Teal versus the State Bar of Wisconsin. Whether it is for all purposes, whether it is for this purpose, I don't think there's a clear answer to that. But assuming for purposes of argument that it is.
What about employees of the State Bar? Are they public employees?
I don't believe that they are public employees. They are not covered by the civil service provisions or anything like that under state law. I believe that's the answer.
Do they participate in the Wisconsin state retirement system?
I don't know the answer to that.
That's okay.
No, I don't
All
think
right. Thanks.
They do. But
What about the idea of defining what the bar's interests are instead of defining it more loosely as what's not in the best interest of the bar? I mean, what I heard when I pressed Mr. DeLasso on that a little bit was, if you engage in criminal conduct or if you engage in ideological activity, right? Because, I mean, you can't force people to be a part of a mandatory bar if the bar is engaging in ideological activity, right? So why not define those things?
But I think
so that people know, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this.
And I think, as Mr. DeLasto said, that approach has certain appeal to it, and as he said, that would have been his preferred approach. But if you look at, for example, the book, I don't remember what it's called, Better Bylaws, I believe what it is, which is one of the sources for these kind of information, there is a debate within the community of those who study these things about which way is better. And generally, the recommendation is to not do a list of horribles, if you will, on the theory that even before you get to the substance of a particular situation, you end up with a prolonged fight about does it even fit in the list.
Well, is that a bad thing? I guess that's part of my question. That's what we're debating here today. You know, should it be more than the whim of the day?
Well,
I think you have good intentions. I think Mr. DeLasso has good intentions. I think Judge Fiedler and everyone here on this, it's not like you're coming in here trying to do something that has an ill purpose. The unintended consequences of good intentions are what we're trying to address here, I think, and see whether this is a good idea or not. So that's why I'm asking it sort of in the reverse, because I'm troubled, frankly, with the idea, not that you or the people here would do something that we would ever question, but would it be better to define what the bar's purpose is and what's in the best interest instead of just saying what's not and then have that be kind of a movable standard depending on the day?
Well, I think the bar's purposes are already defined in this court's rule. So I think to the extent that's part of whether someone's behavior is in the best interest of the bar, I think that's already there.
Well, why don't you refer to it in response to Justice Ziegler's question, which is quite good. Why don't you say what the interests of the bar are? 10.01 says the bar is an association composed of persons licensed to practice law. Well, active members might or might not be licensed. But then it says, to the end, this is sub 2, the association shall promote public interest by maintaining high standards of conduct in the legal profession and aiding in the efficient administration of justice. So you can see it's not in the interest of the bar if it doesn't maintain high standards, if it doesn't aid in the efficient administration of justice. Then you can go to 10.02 sub 2, which has even more interests of the bar, to form local bar associations, to conduct a program of continuing legal education. Maybe people think we ought to get rid of the legal education requirement. So would that be against the best interests of the bar, because its mission here is to foster continuing legal education? And it goes on. So maybe you could just take the negative of some of these and do what and suggest those are against the best interests of the bar.
And I think there's a line, and it's so often the case in the law, it's not always easy to say in words where that line is. But having a healthy debate about what the continuing legal education requirements might be or what the pre-admission education requirements might be, I think that is, in fact, in the best interest of the bar, and reasonable people can disagree about what those what's good and what's bad and who should be doing it and how should we be doing it and how long should it take and all of those things. There is a difference, however, it seems to me, and I think one of the cases we cite in the brief kind of is an analogy to this, in the sense that once the decision is made as to what the law is or what the bar's purposes are as set forth in this court's rules, there is a line that someone who is an officer of the bar or a governor on the Board of Governors should not cross. They have a fiduciary obligation in that role to the organization. While they do not relinquish their own personal rights, they do have an obligation to put the association's rights ahead of their own as a fiduciary. And so they need to be somewhat more circumspect in how they act and how they speak. So, for example, in the Domiano case, which we cite in the brief, in that situation, it was a fire chief who was fired when he took a very public and a very vocal position contrary to the village board's rules about how injured people need to be transported by the local EMTs, of which the fire department was part of that organization. And he went so far as to tell the other members of the organization that they should ignore that law. So in this case, you may have a particular law about which reasonable people could disagree on procedure, on ethics, on all kinds of issues that are directly germane, I know that's a loaded term, to the core purposes of the bar, but which the decision has been made by this court or by the Board of Governors as a whole as to what the rule is. And while that member of the Board of Governors, of that officer, can disagree with that, and a healthy debate about that,